Hey there, welcome to The Chalene Show. Today, we're talking about fasting.
Welcome to The Chalene Show. Chalene is a New York Times bestselling author, celebrity fitness trainer, and obsessed with helping you live your dream life.
Fasting, it's a word, a term, a topic you would have never, ever heard me talking about on The Chalene Show just even 2 years ago. I was afraid of the word. I thought that it was something very dangerous, something very deadly, and something to be avoided at all costs. Boy, was I wrong. More and more people aren't just talking about fasting, they're doing it, and maybe you've considered it too. But are people doing it for the right reasons? And do they know why fasting is so beneficial? What's the best way to go about fasting for health and or longevity? I am so excited for this interview today because today you're going to be hearing from one of the leading experts in the area of metabolism and fasting science. He's here to answer all of your questions and more. This is one of my favorite scientists, someone who we relied very heavily on in the creation of the 131 method. His science is based on autophagy. Autophagy is Nobel Prize award-winning science. And today, you will hear from Dr. Valter Longo of USC, a researcher and best-selling author of the book, The Longevity Diet. Today, he will break down for us why people are suddenly intrigued with fasting, the cellular benefits of fasting for aging, longevity, our immune system, and warding off disease, and so much more. We'll also talk about different types of fasts, including fasting with food. The difference between fasting and just cutting back on your calories and why one is so detrimental to your metabolism and which populations shouldn't be fasting. And we'll even talk about some of the positive and yes, negative side effects of certain types of exercise. That and so much more on The Chalene Show. He really is a wealth of knowledge and research and he's so super smart. I was taking a million notes even while I was interviewing him. You will certainly pick up on his rather prominent Italian accent, but a brilliant man. I look forward to hearing your feedback on this episode. Without further ado, Dr. Valter Longo. Super excited today to be here with Dr. Valter Longo, who is a renowned researcher, a best-selling author. In fact, the author of The Longevity Diet, which checked on Amazon today, number one in your category. Pretty exciting. And I know it's done really, really well in Europe. Anyone who I've been looking to as a thought leader in this area of nutritional science and metabolism, they've either had you on their program or they're referring to your work. So it's a real honor to be here with you today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yes. And I know you've been really busy with a ton of interviews. Why do you think people are suddenly intrigued by fasting?
I think it's because the data, the clinical trials and data in general is also the animal studies are supporting its incredible effects. More research was done and more doctors are starting to maybe not accepting of it, but certainly considering it for their therapy of their patients. I think people followed. And also some of the stars, I think, have done a lot for it. So there have been some stars that have started doing fasting.
Maybe that'll balance out some of the negative effects of celebrities who've promoted different diets, you know? I think that partly it's great because if someone who's got a following can expose the public to science, it's great. It's just sad, I think, sometimes when people see a celebrity and they're like, oh, this is what they're doing, therefore it must work. Therefore, this person must have credibility.
Yes, of course, you know, that is potentially problematic. I always say you wouldn't let anybody do brain surgery, and longevity and nutrition are both very, very complex. And people don't realize it because we all age and we all eat, right? And so there's a tendency to simplify and think, well, you know, how hard could it be to learn how to eat properly? But it's very tricky, particularly when you get into the territory we're getting into now, which is not just how you eat, but, for example, regenerating systems and cells and components of the cells. So it's getting really to another level that is not so much about nutrition, but much more about resetting, rebuilding, rejuvenating.
Yeah. I'm glad that you said it's not that simple. We want it to be simple. You know, we want it to be really easy. But if you think about the most rewarding things, like even a marriage or anything that's really complicated, it's not going to be simple, but it's very rewarding and very powerful if you're willing to understand and commit to the fact that it's just not that simple. There isn't one way that everyone's supposed to eat or everyone's supposed to exercise that is the answer. What is it that led you to your study and research on fasting?
First, I started with aging, actually, longevity. And there was, you know, back in college, actually, my second year in college. And a few years after, I started working on nutrition and aging. I was a student at UCLA in the early 90s of Roy Walford. And Roy was one of the, well, at the time, he actually was the leading figure in the world for nutrition and longevity. And so it was a great experience. And he was a guru of something called calorie restriction.
Yes.
But then I left his lab and I went back to the biochemistry department, where I started working on starvation, first in bacteria. I mean, Roy was working on people and mice. It was pretty obvious that we needed to know about the genes and what were the genes that regulate aging and how were they connected with the nutrients. So that required a lot more of a molecular approach. And that's why I started working with bacteria and yeast. And my initial observation was that if you starve bacteria or yeast, baker's yeast, what's used to make bread, they live a lot longer and they become stronger, right? And that was very surprising. At the beginning, I thought it was a mistake. But then, because you think of starvation, fasting as something negative, something that's going to make you weaker. So then, you know, because evolutionarily they're so far apart, bacteria and baker's yeast, then it was clear that there was something very fundamental that went back to the origin of organisms. And then since then, it's all I've done is really to study nutrient response genes.
So yeast, bacteria, mice, and then ultimately human trials. Is it fair to say that starvation, which is such a weird, scary word for people, but is it fair to say that starvation benefits all organisms to some extent?
It's fair to say that if you know how to use it, if you know how to exploit it, it can benefit all organisms that we've seen. But it can also hurt all organisms. So you have to know the mechanisms, you have to know what genes are involved, and you have to know how to time it.
In terms of the powerful benefits from a cellular standpoint, when we're talking about starvation or fasting versus calorie restriction, what is the difference? And why is there a difference?
Yeah, well, in one case, you're basically just giving the signal to the body, I just have less food.
Less.
And so everything goes down and everything is reduced chronically. And that includes your muscle and probably at least some immune functions. Now, keep in mind that you don't need to be weaker in all areas to be killed or to be in trouble, right? It could be that you're weaker in 20% of the defenses. And it's just a matter of time before that particular bug you're going to be exposed to.
Right.
And then you have a problem, right? So that's calorie restriction. Very positive, chronic, very hard to do. Because obviously, imagine if somebody told you right now, from now on, you eat 30% less.
I don't think you have to imagine. I think a lot of us have done that.
Well, I mean, for the rest of your life.
Sure. Right?
So this is
impossible.
Very, very difficult. And, you know, periodic fasting instead. And by fasting, I mean prolonged, periodic and prolonged fasting. So something lasting 3, 4, 5 days or longer. This causes very different changes. All of a sudden, the body is not just a restriction of calorie, you're just eliminating all calories. So the body is forced to switch to a ketogenic mode. It's forced to go, and we found out that it gets its fuel from the belly fat. And all of the fuel from the belly fat. It doesn't really go after the subcutaneous fat. It goes to the belly fat, and that's probably because, and it makes sense, right? That's the tank, right? That's the fuel tank. At the same time, it goes after almost every system, right? The muscle, the immune system, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems to be able to recognize, and we're still only at the beginning of this understanding, it seems to be able to recognize the good and the bad, right? So if something is damaged, let's say a cancer cell, it kills the cancer cell much more. I mean, the normal cell becomes protected and the cancer cells dies, right? So it's very differential facts. And let's say autoimmune cell dies, and yet the stem cell, the hematopoietic stem cells that give rise to immune cells, they are activated, right?
And that's a very different process than when someone's calorie restricting. And is that because of the metabolic system? Because when someone's calorie restricting, there's still well, there's still glucose and glycogen, and they haven't burned through those stores, so they're not into a ketogenic state. Is that why they're so different? Is when you go into a ketogenic state?
Yeah. So when you're calorie restricted, you have a lot of fuel, and you're just smaller. So, you know, at some point, you weigh 30% less, and you eat 30% less, right?
Yeah.
So the body just goes into this new mode, but there is nothing different, nothing that different from before. When you fast, it's not so much only the fasting. That's another mistake that is commonly made, is the fasting and the refeeding, right?
Yes.
So the fasting has the job of breaking down. Why? Well, first of all the mass that you have, it requires energy, right?
Right.
So I always talk about a wood train, wood burning train. That's an analogy that I use. And imagine now you're running out of fuel.
Right.
You're 100 miles from the next station. And so what do? Well, first of all, you burn wood, let's say the chairs, the walls that are... What you don't need, but you will go pick the ones that are in the worst shape, right?
Yeah.
The ones that are broken, you know, first, right? If you were the owner of the train. And so you burn them. Now you get to the train station, and in the train station, you can rebuild, right? You can now take new wood and rebuild. So now you have a new train, and then made it to the next station. And that's exactly what the body does, right? So you need to be lighter because you need to have less weight, but at the same time, you want to use that as fuel.
Yes.
So you want to use yourself as fuel, your train. So in our case, of course, we use the fat that is accumulated here. And most people have a couple months of reserve, right?
Of fat.
I mean, people are worried about 5 days, and they don't realize that they have several months of reserves on average.
That brings me to a point. We know, based on your research and a lot of other research that's available to us, the powerful benefits of fasting. Do you have a recommendation on how frequently a healthy individual should be fasting? And is there a sliding scale kind of based on health? Like, so if someone's got very high cholesterol, very overweight, should they be fasting more often or less often than someone who would be, quote unquote, healthy body weight, healthy body fat?
Yeah, people can do it one time, two times. In the long run, you're going to get hurt by water-only fasting. Why? It pushes your system to very low glucose level. It can push your system to low blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people can do it very easily. And a lot of people will be pushed into a condition that is very problematic, let's say. So, of course, I follow thousands and thousands of people during the many years that I've been doing it. And, you know, most people are okay, but a lot of people are not.
Mm.
And so this is why we introduced a fasting mimicking diet and Prolon. And I should say that I gain nothing financially from it. You know, everything that all my part goes to a foundation called Create Cures Foundation.
Love that.
But the reason I developed it was first for cancer patients. We were starting the clinical trials. We noticed that cancer patients did not want to do their fasting, water-only fasting, and the oncologists did not want them to undergo water-only fasting. So the National Cancer Institute, the government, gave us funds to develop a fasting mimicking diet. And so then eventually we tested it clinically for everybody else. You know, and also realize how important it was to standardize it, to allow people to do something that was clinically tested, it was safe. And now, for example, we have over 20,000 people that have done it with the kit.
Can we talk about the kit for a second?
Yeah.
So I think this is brilliant because I agree that there, you know, whether it's from a psychological standpoint that someone doesn't want to fast or doesn't feel comfortable fasting, or maybe from a metabolic flexibility standpoint, they're not prepared to fast. This is a great alternative for them. So this is the fast mimicking diet that you've designed that helped the body basically believe it's in fasting, that it's in a fasting state.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very specific, the diet. Well, when I look at the macros of it, it's certainly not a ketogenic diet. So how is it that it's tricking the body or mimicking fasting?
Yeah, so the understanding of the role of each nutrient and how each nutrient is connected to each gene. So, for example, we're looking at amino acids. Which amino acids control IGF-1, insulin? Which control TOR? What about carbohydrates? Which one control PKA? Mm-hmm. So we have all this network of genes that we've been studying for a long time, and we know they control both protection, aging, but they also control regeneration, right?
Mm.
They control the activation of stem cells. They control autophagy, the process by which cells eat themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So we manipulate, I mean, we exploit this knowledge to get the system to do what we needed to do without undergoing water-only fasting. So basically, this is between 750 and 1,100 calories per day.
Which is great. I mean, you're not fasting.
Yeah, you're not fasting. And I think for people, it's also the ritual of eating, breakfast, lunch, dinner, etc. is very important, and a snack. You know, of course, I've done it both ways, with water only and with the fasting mimicking diet. You know, of course, it's not very easy to do with the fasting mimicking diet, but it's easy enough that I don't feel, when I have to do it, I don't feel like,
this is a
nightmare for me. You know? Yeah. So that makes a big difference.
Now, if you were to measure ketones while they're following a fasting mimicking diet, is their ketone elevation still there? Are they in ketosis?
Yeah, so the ketones are up. And the idea of the fasting mimicking diet was developed first in mice and then moved to humans for the property of affecting IGF-1, IGF-BP1, glucose and ketone bodies, right? So the ketones, we're trying to match the same levels that the water-only fasting achieves.
I've heard you speak pretty frankly about this overpopularization of the ketogenic diet and people who are, you know, kind of putting their flag in the sand and saying, I'm keto for life, and that there hasn't been any long-term studies, but yet there are some benefits when people, you know, phase a ketogenic diet for a short period of time. What is your thought or beliefs on this trend of people just really getting excited about, look, here's the answer, it's high fat and low carbohydrates?
Yeah, it's very scary. And I mean, it's going to end up probably in the same place that all the other ideas, improvised ideas, end up. You know, the misinterpretation, for example, of the Mediterranean diet ended up in the world's worst epidemic on obesity. Mm. And of course, it was a pretty good idea turned into a nightmare.
Yeah.
And here we go again. I think now we're turning a pretty good idea, which is fasting and the ketone bodies generated by fasting are good, and fats, if you pick the right ones, and only if you pick the right ones, are not so bad for you. And we're turning into a nightmare, which is going to be what most people do, eat a high protein, high fat, animal-based diet. You know, in the book I talk about, I start with the five pillars of longevity. So I basically start by saying, well, let's have a very comprehensive system in identifying diet. You know,
yeah.
So I talk about epidemiology. So let's look at 100,000 people. They had a ketogenic diet or not, which ones do better? And the ketogenic diet do very bad, you know, if you look at the epidemiological studies. Then let's look at clinical data. There is not very much clinical data, you know, not very many studies where you put some people on this and some people on that. Let's look at centenarian studies.
Yes.
And none of the long-lived people, the groups around the world, whether it's Okinawa, Loma Linda, Sardinia, Calabria, Greece, Costa Rica, none of them have a ketogenic diet.
Right.
And in animal studies, the fourth pillar, basic science, animal studies. Well, especially if it's high protein, the data, not so much high fat, but high protein, high fat, the data indicates that the animals live shorter.
Mm-hmm.
There are some recent studies that show that high fat diet can extend a little bit the life of a mouse, but these are not big effects. And so you put it all together, and there was a high fat, low protein, by the way. Right?
High fat, low protein.
Yeah, high fat, low protein. So high fat, low protein, I mean, at least theoretically, it could be good, but practically, and I mean, I don't gain anything by going one way or another. I mean, my job is to make people live long.
That's why I'm here.
You know. So, you know, let's say that eventually it could work, but because none of the pillars sustain it, you really potentially jeopardizing your chances of making it to 90 healthy, which are already very good, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you have probably people that are born now have a very good chance of making it to 90 pretty healthy. So you don't want to give that up for the possibility of living 5% longer when there is a huge possibility you're going to live a lot shorter.
You refer to the centenarians a lot in the book, which I love. And generally speaking, diets that are very low in animal protein, lots of greens, a little bit of fish. Is that accurate? Maybe some nuts, some healthy fats, but much lower in protein than what a standard American diet looks like.
Yeah. Actually, in the book, I talk about 60-30-10, right? So 60% carbohydrates, 30% fats, and 10% protein. And so fats are there, and they're pretty high. So olive oil and nuts and salmon and et cetera, they're there in pretty high quantities, enough to get you to 30% of your calorie intake.
Mm-hmm.
And the protein, 10%, you know, so that turns out to be about 0.335 grams per pound of body weight. So if you weigh 100 pounds, that would be about 40 grams of proteins.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be a good and very safe way to go. Now, when you get older, this should go up a little bit, and the variety probably needs to be better, meaning that, for example, if you look at some of the long-lived places, the elderly may eat yogurt and some cheese, mm-hmm. and particularly from goat and sheep.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So eggs are also very common in the elderly. So these are things that might not be a bad idea after 65 to start introducing, have more nourishment. It's going to have probably a positive effect. And this is also based on our own studies on proteins showing that until age 65, the low protein in a U.S. population was protective against cancer and overall mortality. But after age 65, the people that reported having the lowest protein intake or a very low protein intake did not do very well. In fact, they seem to have a trend or did worse than everybody else. So I think as people get frail and lose a lot of muscle mass, that having not a high protein level, but a moderate level of protein, and more of a variety of food may become more important than some of these control of genes that regulate aging, which by that time, for example, something called IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor 1, is already so low in a 70-year-old.
Right, right. It might not have that much of an effect.
Pushing it lower may have a detrimental effect and not a beneficial one.
I see.
Whereas somebody that is young, that is 45, and that has...
45 is young.
Yeah.
Just for the record.
And may have an IGF-1 level of 300. Now, that's associated with breast cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer, et cetera, et cetera. And so you want to lower it.
Mm. So something that's been kind of confusing to me is the benefits of fasting. It seems that a lot of the autophagy is happening when we're in a state of ketosis. So how is nutritional ketosis, or is nutritional ketosis, if you were to do it in phases, and I'm not talking about doing indefinite, you know, eating ketogenic indefinitely, but to do phasing, maybe a short-term period of time where you're eating ketogenically to get into that nutritional ketosis, does that have any of the same benefits as starvation or fasting and getting into ketosis through that method?
We don't know, but, you know, theoretically, it's going to have much more limited effects because, I mean, the power of the fasting mimicking diets and the fasting is that you require the breakdown and you require the rebuilding. And when you have a ketogenic diet, I mean, basically the message to the system is there's plenty of food. It just happens to be different food.
Yeah.
The system is going to adapt, and then you can end up actually with glucose levels that are not that much different from those. I mean, it depends which ketogenic diet you have. And I mean, these things are still not studied very well. But you can have ketogenic diets that then end up with normal glucose level, and really normal energy level. You just happen to get it from somewhere else. So that's why it's just missing the theoretical foundation for why should you rebuild when you have plenty of food. There is no reason to break down muscle. There is no reason to break down liver cells. There is no reason to break down immune cells because, you know, you have plenty of food.
Right.
Why would you do that?
Right. You know, something I've asked quite a few experts about, and I'd love to have your input on this, and I'm not sure if you've done or looked at studies regarding exogenous ketones, but their popularity is climbing with, you know, this everyone like trying to figure out a way to biohack and taking man-made ketones. And I know it really depends on how you're taking them and what your diet looks like at the time. But for someone who's eating a diet that's relatively moderate protein, moderate carbohydrates, it's not a ketogenic diet, and then on top of that they're adding exogenous ketones, would there be benefit to that, or is that confusing the system?
That's a bad idea no matter who does it. You know?
Yeah.
Why is that a bad idea? If you make your own ketone bodies, I mean, if you have a ketogenic diet, it could be reasonable, right? You can imagine eating a high fat, high protein diet, for example, by eating a lot of animal food, you know. So once in a while, that's probably okay, you know, if you to do like a week of a ketogenic diet. Adding ketones, ketone bodies, to the existing diet instead, it's very scary, right? Because now all of a sudden, you're giving, for example, your brain has plenty of glucose. And during starvation, the glucose is lowered and the ketone bodies go up, and the brain uses both at about the same level, right? Now, if you have glucose that is very high and all of a sudden you have these ketone bodies, not just the brain, but all the system, now you're going to have two signals coming in, and basically the system must get confused and say, well, what do I do now? Because I've never been in this situation. I have lots of sugar.
Yeah.
And now I'm all of a sudden
ketone
I have
bodies.
both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very scary.
Well, and they're both an energy source. So I guess what I've always wondered is, when you have an excess of energy, it's stored, right?
I'm not so worried about storage. I'm much more worried about dysfunction and pushing, the brain, you know, hormones and neurotransmitters, etc., into a state where maybe you're overexciting neurons or you're pushing the system into a situation where it can burn out, essentially, right? I mean, nobody's ever shown that, but if you look at it theoretical level, it's like saying, imagine if you had a hybrid car, right?
Okay.
And a hybrid car, it can go either on electricity or on fuel.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you impose, not in a way that it was built by the engineers to do so, right? Because, you know, you could do all the tests and then, you know, have the electric and the gasoline both provide power for the car, right?
Okay.
But if all of a sudden now you tweak something and you do it by using a hammer, essentially,
sure.
Right? And then and all of a sudden now you use this bot, what do you think is going to happen to the car in the long run, right?
A malfunction.
I mean, it probably will break down,
right? Yeah.
It's just not made to have bot function at the same time. Not that it cannot do it, but it was not engineered to do that. And the human body is not engineered to have a normal diet and keto bodies on top of it, right? So, bad idea.
One of the main concerns, especially a population that exercises a lot and is interested in building muscle, is that fasting is going to, you know, when you're in that state of starvation, that the body is going to not just attack body fat, but also to break down muscle. What role does human growth hormone have in the fasted state?
Well, let me first answer the question by saying we did that in the clinical trial, and it's not true, you know. And now, so what happens is that the body breaks down the fat, as I was saying earlier, it breaks down the muscle temporarily, and then when you refeed, the muscle is rebuilt.
So if you're measuring body fat, you might not see a drop in body fat. You might actually see a drop in body fat, but an increase after refueling in muscle composition?
Yeah, you see a drop in body fat, a drop in abdominal fat, and an increase in relative lean body mass.
Wow.
And you see no changes or very slight reduction in lean body mass, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you really see the body now be more muscle and less fat proportionally, and the fat went back to the normal level. And it makes sense, right? Again, you know, if this is an evolved process, so you wouldn't want to reduce the muscle of someone once in a while having been exposed to this starvation. You want to get through the starvation period, the fasting period, and then rebuild all the muscle. Now, we suspect that, in fact, the opposite is true. And now we have a clinical trial at the University of Verona in Italy that is measuring just that. It just started, and we are measuring muscle mass, muscle strength.
Ooh, this is going to be exciting.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens. But we suspect that by turning on stem cells, by replacing bad cells with good cells, or replacing bad cellular components with good cellular components, intracellular components, that the muscle not only will go back to this mass, will be stronger.
Is it hard for you to get the type of funding that you need to do this kind of research when it's not attached to a pharmaceutical? It's not attached to a drug. It's basically what you're teaching us is that your body has the ability to heal itself and to repair DNA and to improve our cellular function without pharmaceuticals. Is it difficult to get funding?
Yes and no. I mean, we've had a lot of funds, but if you think about what we're talking about now, which is that next to all this medicine that people take, and I mean, medicines are not going to go away, and a lot of them are good medicine, yeah. But if you think about the possibility now that the self-repair activated by fasting and fasting mimicking diet could really be the first option to many, many patients, whether you are pre-diabetic or diabetic, whether you have autoimmunities of many, many different kinds, whether you have, you know, neurodegenerative changes, etc., then you say the health of the National Institute of Health should sponsor fasting research or some type of, not fasting, but certainly nutrition and longevity research. And, you know, of course, we're at levels that are orders of magnitude away from that. So, you know, there's a few percent of the NIH, the National Institute of Health, that sponsors this type of research, but not on fasting. It sponsors aging research, which then is really spread out to many, many different interventions. And of course, yeah, I understand everybody's got a different idea. But I think if you just look at potential of things that are out there, clearly fasting and fasting mimicking diets, and not just those. I mean, of course, there's some type of ketogenic diets that for certain diseases, for example, now for glioma, we're recommending to certain patients that are out of options. We're saying, well, the best we think is FMD, fasting mimicking diet periodically, ketogenic diet in between, as long as you can handle it, and then radiotherapy and chemotherapy.
Wow.
Right? So do it all together.
And employing all the systems.
In some patients, it seems to be working very well. So, you know, these are very aggressive, very rapidly. I mean, tumors that can kill someone very rapidly. So, you know, we can really say to people, wait until the clinical trial is over, because they're not going to be around when the clinical trial is over. So just to say, this is not just about fasting. I call it nutri-technology. Right?
Yeah.
So it's about understanding how nutrients can be used to do this self-repair and regeneration, rejuvenation, etc.
You've been in the longevity business, if you will, for many, many years. That's what you're surrounded
30
with.
Years.
30 years. I've been in kind of the aesthetic business for 30 years. So it might be a little bit of, you know, our experiences, but I guess my concern is that most people are more motivated by what they're going to look like today versus how long and the quality of their life. Like, I think if you ask the average person, would you want to be your ideal weight and look amazing and live to be 75? Or would you want to live a very healthy, vibrant life and live to be 100? I think you'd get a pretty even split. I guess what I'm wondering is, do you think people are more motivated by the aesthetic of what they can do with their nutrition or longevity and quality of life?
Yeah, people absolutely are more worried about losing fat and losing weight and looking good. And so we're basically saying, okay, let's exploit that. We want them to live to 100 healthy, but maybe there's a way to get both.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is what the periodic fasting mimicking diet come in, because they basically say, you know, on average for, you know, 115 days out of 4 months, or almost every single one of the days in the 4 months, you can eat your normal diet.
Food, yep.
And then for 5 days, at the end of that, you're just going to have to do the fasting mimicking diet. So keep your diet. That's okay. Even though, you know, in the book, for example, half of the book is about how you should eat.
Yes.
But also understanding that, let's say, at least 50% are not going to listen to it. You know, they're going to say, look, I can eliminate red meat. I can eliminate cheese. I can eliminate smoke, right? So a lot of people are going to keep doing what it is that they do. And then you have to say, okay, we're scientists. How good are we? Well, let's just be good enough to say, if you're not going to change, we have something for you too. You know, instead of saying, no, you know, the only way.
All or nothing.
So, yeah, then you lose your abdominal fat with the fasting mimicking diet. You don't lose your muscle. And then what we're interested in, you're reducing your markers of diseases and risk factor for diseases, cholesterol, triglycerides, blood pressure, IGF-1, systemic inflammation, etc. So I think, you know, it took us 30 years. I mean, it took me 30 years to get there. But now, you know, this is why I also wrote the book, because I'm like, okay, now I think I got it.
Yeah.
You know, now I think I found out how to not change necessarily people, how to make it simple, how to please them at the weight level,
right,
at the muscle level.
Right.
Because, you know, these problems
all
have
these
been
things
in my head since the very beginning.
Yeah.
You know, people don't want to lose muscle. I mean,
right,
people look at Walford and my former mentor and say, he looks terrible, you know. He looks like he's emaciated,
right,
you know. And he was a real pioneer, and he didn't have the tools that we have now.
Yeah.
But so now we have it, and now using the molecular biology and nutrient technology, I think we're getting there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I hope that the doctors, now we have close to 3,000 doctors in the United States that are recommending Prolon, and thousands in Europe. So
amazing.
I think, you know, we're on the way to changing the system.
Yeah.
You know, we'll see how far we get, but we feel pretty good about it. And, you know, this is why I also gave everything away, because people started thinking, oh, yeah, he's trying to make money doing this, you know. And so at some point they say, you know what, I'm just going to give away 100%. So
that
criticism, even the book
silenced.
Is 100%. Is the royalties are owned by my foundation now. So I get zero from all of this, right?
Wow. Wow. I love that you also refer to exercise and longevity. So tell me what you think are some of the biggest mistakes people are making, those who are exercising. Are we over-exercising? Are we doing the wrong types of exercise? Are we, you know, too caught up in HIIT training or, you know, workouts that just abuse the body? Or are we not doing enough?
number one mistake, I think, is to think that I love the photograph where you have a gym and then you have an escalator and the stairs and everybody's on the escalator,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen
that. I have, and I know the gym too.
Yeah, yeah. So the number one mistake is to think that we need to exercise necessarily in a gym. I mean, exercise should be every day being active.
Moving your body.
Yeah, so for example, I have things very simple in the book. Whenever you talk to people about going to lunch, they'll say, well, let's pick the closest place possible. And I say, no, pick a place that is 15 minutes away, right? And now you just did 30 minutes of walking.
Yeah.
And then you go get coffee, pick another place. Now it's an hour of walking. And that's already very good. Of course, it doesn't replace exercise. I talk about in the book using meta-analysis, so review of large studies, 150 minutes of exercise per week. Mm-hmm. 300 minutes doesn't really add very much. Mm. So I tell people, stay with 150. That's okay. You know, that's 20 minutes a day or 40 minutes every other day.
That's kind of a baseline. You'll have to correct me if I read this wrong, but I thought you said, you know, generally speaking, about 5.5 hours a week of exercise. Is that something that you would think people should strive for, or is that a baseline?
No, it's not 5.5 hours. It's 150 minutes, so it's 2.5 hours.
Okay.
Yeah, 2.5 hours. If you look at multiple studies and you look at the benefits of 5 hours versus 2.5,
okay,
it's not that much. You know, the effect on mortality is like 5% more, 7% more. So yeah, it's better.
Sure.
But to most people, it's probably like not that important, you know. But the 150, so
yes,
the 40 minutes every other day, mm-hmm, that's very important. That's huge effects compared to people that don't do it.
Yeah.
And then...
is it the everyday? So for me personally, exercise is about longevity. Exercise is about my state of mind today. It's so that I don't kill someone. It's so that it's my form of meditation. It's my form of kind of feeling like I'm honoring my body and my health. So it's something I strive to do every day. I don't want to beat myself up every day, but it's something I feel like, gosh, if I've got the ability to move and exercise every day, I should do something.
Yes,
and I know you exercise almost daily, right?
And you can, yeah, every other day. I think you can. The problem is that, you know, of course, most people cannot do it, don't want to do it. So I think it's good to say, give me something that
doable.
Is doable, but also that optimizes. Don't overdo it for me. And I mean, of course, if somebody loves to run or bike or whatever, they could do it. Now, there is a potential problem is a lot of the athletes, at least according to people that study them, are in bad shape, you know, by the time they get to 50.
Bad shape in what way? On a cellular level?
Well, you know, in the book, one of my pillars is cars and planes, right? Mm-hmm. And I say, you know, what happens if you overdrive a car, right? Even though you take it to the mechanic, the body shop, eventually cars that have too many miles, nobody wants, right?
Yeah.
And why is that? You know, it's got the same age, biological, I mean, chronological age is another car that has less miles. It just got too many miles. We drove it too much, right? And so most likely that's what happens. I mean, the body can repair itself, but if you keep pushing and damaging, you know, like if you're running an hour and a half a day, you know, after 50, 60, 70 years of that, the body is going to start, you know, not being able to recuperate.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, I've heard that some people that study athletes don't publish the data, the bad data, the very negative data, because they're afraid that everybody's going to get the message that
they shouldn't exercise.
They shouldn't exercise, which is then, you know, even worse.
Sure.
Right? So, of course, you should exercise, but overdoing it is because, you know, then the journals and the newspaper could say, oh, exercise now is bad for you.
Yeah.
And the headlines would be that, right?
Of course.
And of course, you don't want the headlines because exercise is actually very good for you. But over-exercising may actually be bad for you.
I think that's kind of a theme of your book, too, is that I love that there's so many really doable examples. And you give very specifics, recommendations to people, especially in terms of exercise. So they kind of know, like, here's what it could look like. And if nothing else, I think that you've done a fantastic job of making this really easy to consume and really doable for people. And I love that you're having such a tremendous impact on the healthcare system, on people in my industry who are health and fitness and wellness, and helping us to understand it's not just how great you look, it's how great you feel. And longevity is really such an important marker. So thank you for your 30 years of study.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah.
I really appreciate it. It's been our honor to have you here today.
Thanks.
So you want to check out the book, Dr. Longo. It's been an honor to be here with you today. The book is The Longevity Diet, and you can find it on Amazon and probably also maybe on your website.
No, no, not on my website. And Barnes & Nobles and all the bookstores, yeah, they should have it. Yeah.
So go and check that out. Thanks again, Dr. Longo, for being here with us today.
This episode of The Chalene Show was brought to you by 131 Method. I want you to check it out. Go to 131method.com. In fact, you'll find a link to that website in the show notes for this podcast. What is it? Well, it's the reason why I took almost a year off of podcasting. It was more than 2 years in the development. It was the answers I was looking for. You know, why was it I kept hearing everyone who went on a diet, almost 95% of people who go on a diet, gain all the weight back and then some? Why is it we keep trying to force feed a one-size-fits-all diet on everybody? Why do we keep trying to do the same thing over and over and over again, yet as a nation, as a world, we're getting more and more obese? It just didn't make any sense to me. And why are we exercising ourselves into the ground and we've got Fitbits and trackers and calorie counts and low-fat foods, but why are we more obese and sicker than we've ever been in our history? Why do people suffer from brain fog and ADD and autism and all these autoimmune diseases? Like, it didn't add up. So I took a couple of years off to do some deep research, and then a year of testing a methodology, testing that we did with over 25,000 people. And the results are remarkable. Stop dieting. That's my message to you. Stop dieting. Please go visit 131method.com and learn more about this movement.